The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
Now, we've kept the Culture Club going all through the pandemic, but this is the first time since March I've had the opportunity to meet a Culture Club guest face to face. The comedian and author of Anne Devine, Handle With Care, is with us for the Culture Club. Colm O'Regan, thank you very much for coming in to join us.
I'm delighted to see you in 3D. I won't test. We'll stay 2 metres apart, but it is great to be here.
We're managing the social distance, but thank you for your bravery in coming into the studio. Tell us, before we talk about all your choices, we do need to give you a chance to tell us a little bit about your new novel, your second Anne Devine book.
Yeah, it's a follow-up to the first. So it's we return to the village of Kilsudgeon, which is a fictional village somewhere in Ireland. I describe it as a village recovering from a bypass. And this time round, Anne is, like a lot of people, coping with big issues and small issues, family issues and issues around the area. So the big thing that's happening is that the post office is in danger of closing, which for many small towns in Ireland that are one victory or one defeat away from triumph or disaster, a post office going is a big deal. And that gets local people protesting, and protesting starts to attract members of call them alt-right or far-right or the Sons of Eru or whatever, all that kind of that milieu. And it's so part of the novel is a little bit of a satire of what happens when people who are very, very different start campaigning under the one umbrella. It's set also in 2018, which I think is a good summer in Ireland because it's bookended by repeal and the Pope's visit, which are two very different aspects of Ireland. And so the book kind of plays with how those things mix in a small town and in a family within a small town.
It's funny how you, when you mentioned the Pope's visit, I suddenly think, oh, yeah, there was a Pope's visit in 2018.
That's right, yeah.
It seems so far ago now at this stage.
I didn't think when writing a novel set 2 years ago that I would somehow be writing a nostalgic piece about the time where you could go to an event with your only considerations being traffic, transport, and whether you needed to bring a coat for the rain. But now, you know, things that I took for granted while writing the book, like the family go to a restaurant, and it's like, well, remember that? Remember when you would go to a restaurant? The restaurant is in the new hipster restaurant in Kilsudgeon's neighbouring village, a restaurant which was formerly a mechanics place, and the pit is still there. And there's even a table down in the pit. That is not based on reality, but I'm waiting for one restaurant to put it. Exactly. Little did I know how prophetic my setups would be. So
I presume you're writing your third Anne Devine novel now based in COVID-19 2020, are you?
Well, we'll see how this one goes. But I'm definitely, as an observer and indeed just a person who is living in the middle of it like everybody else, looking at the kind of, do you call them unexpected consequences, the byproducts of what happens when a country faces a crisis all at the same time? You know, the idea that you would that you wouldn't have access to your hairdresser or your barber for 6 months. So, you know, the idea that
Can I ask you, have you always had that very full beard and very long hair?
Yeah, the beard is definitely is 6 years old this year. Although I did shave it off in a prudent move during lockdown, because I said nobody's going to see me anyway at various stages. I'll have it grown back by the time anyone wants to see my face. And the hair then is a bit longer than normal. But as a man in early 40s, I am growing the hair that grows and letting it cover up anything that where it doesn't, you know. Yeah, people will empathize.
Well, the new book is Anne Devine, Handle With Care. But let's move on to your choices for Culture Club. And one that we do to everyone who is a guest on this section is ask them to name the first single that they ever bought. But you don't have one, apparently.
No, I didn't buy a single. I think I might have been towards the tail end, like at the kind of, I became a teenager, 1991, 92. I had three older brothers, and I kind of, a lot of the music percolated down from them. So a lot of the time my choice and my tastes were predetermined, very good. Like I wasn't stuck with a lot of rubbish. And so I kind of inherited lots of music. And I think I felt the need that my first thing I bought would stand the test of time. You know, the way, you know, the notions you have about yourself as an arbiter of taste, age 12 or 13. So I didn't buy a single, but the first album I bought, a conscious look to the future. I bought Tom Waits' debut album. Obviously, it wasn't when it came out, but it was his first album, Closing Time.
You were what age when you bought that?
I was 13, I think.
Very precocious, pretentious 13-year-old, perhaps.
Pretentious, rather. Pretension with an eye to people calling me precocious, I think, was the plan.
Let's hear a little bit from that classic album from Tom Waits. This is the much-loved song, Martha.
Operator, number please. It's been so many years. She remembered my old voice while I fight the tears. Hello, hello, there is this Martha. This is old Tom Frost. And I am calling long distance. Don't worry about the cost. Cause it's been 40 years or more now, Martha, please.
How well does that stand the test of time for you?
I think it's still in there, and I'm laughing because it's so it is definitely not Love's Young Dream or Unrequited Teenage Love, or it's not Teenage Kicks. I'm kind of almost embarrassed at what I was trying to, the image I was trying to portray of myself as a lovelorn 50 something in a dive bar. But I'm delighted that I, you know, listened to Tom Waits. Like Tom Waits, if apart from the music, you ever watch old Tom Waits interviews, like Tom Waits on The Late Late Show, where Gayborn doesn't know what to make of him, and, you know, Gayborn asking him a question, Tom Waits just lighting a cigarette for for half a minute, and it's just, and that voice is so, like, you better know what you're talking about when you come at that voice, you know what I mean? So I'm delighted that I've always liked Tom Waits.
Even if you're not old enough to remember buying a first single, you were from a generation that put together compilation tapes or bought them.
That's right. And I feel like it's come full circle. My brothers used to tape Fanning's Fab 50 and bits of Dave Fanning. And I taped a huge amount of John Kelly, Donal Deneen, Carl Tsiginas from Radio Ireland days. I'm going to change to Today FM. I probably still have 10 of those compilation tapes, because from 7 until 1 was just, it was Dave Fanning, but on like hyperspeed, because it was just so much music that from all over the world or from all eras, experimental and traditional and the whole lot. And so I still have those tapes, those little TDK 90s and Castell and BASF. They're stored somewhere, and just that little, the handwriting of, you know, writing down those Northern soul classics. It's just, it's I'll always be thankful to Today FM for the musical education they gave me in those early years.
Okay, I think you had down a secondhand David Bowie compilation called Changes Bowie as well, which I'm sure Ian Dempsey would highly approve of. But we asked you for a favourite album or favourite band. So tell us about the album you've picked out, because you've sort of touched on it there in that you went for sort of the soul background. You've gone for James Brown.
Yes. My brother bought this and he brought it into the house. It's a live album. And it is James Brown live at the Apollo. I think it's his first time there. And when it came out, it was so, it was the experience of listening to it. DJs used to play the whole thing from start to finish because it was a show. It was only less than half an hour long. It has an intro that some people know off by heart, where he introduces James Brown, you know, the hardest working man in show business, you know, introduced the songs he's going to sing. He's the hype man that, you know, hip hop has hype man. This was the hype man introducing James Brown. And in it, the fever pitch of the audience both people who were carried away and also people taking the piss. Like, he was being heckled. You can still hear heckles. Like, James Brown is singing, like, I believe somebody out here lost someone. You can hear a woman saying, yeah, it was you, man, it was you. And it's just, like, for something created, I think, in the early 60s.
1962 is the album, yeah.
And you listen to it all. No, it was on vinyl, so it was on two sides. But if you listen to, you know, on any other format, you listen to it right through, just reaching this crescendo. And I always wonder about how did James Brown's band know he was going to finish or move on to even to the next verse? Because he'd have these just, and I believe some of that here lost someone. And he'd go on for 10 minutes chatting to the audience. But
that must be when Bono got his inspiration.
Maybe. But the band would keep on just, you know, with the rhythm, and then obviously there'd be a nod or they'd know from him that this, now we're going ready to move on to the next verse. But as a listening experience, it is so rich and emotional.
Well, we only have a short extract from Live at the Apollo. This is James Brown's Lost Someone.
Now I want you to know I'm not singing a song for myself now. I'm not singing a song only for myself now. I'm singing it for you too. And when I say something that makes you feel good inside, when I say that little thing, I said that little part that might sting you in your heart now, I want to hear you scream. I want to hear you say, ow! I want to hear you say, ow! Don't just say, ow, say, ow! And I believe my work will be done.
James Brown from Live at the Apollo in 1962. Now, we always ask everyone to remember their best gigs. We're almost reluctant to do so at the moment because gigs is that so many people listening miss. The community of going to a gig, the excitement of seeing a band you really love or an artist and the enjoyment out of it. But we'll have some memories, hopefully. You've picked Sonic Youth in June 1999 in New York as your favourite. Why?
Well, I don't remember much about, so I like Sonic Youth anyway. And I remember I don't know if you remember, in the English Market in Cork, there used to be, it might still be there, the Rave Shop, where you'd get your Joe Bloggs jeans. But there was a Sonic Youth t-shirt that I was circling, like, for people remember circling clothes, that they'd kind of look at them from afar.
Should I go?
Yeah, it's a fiver. I've only got one fiver. I better make this count. But I went to New York on a J1, which again is another nostalgia trigger point. The J1, no J1s this year, which again robs a generation of 19, 20 year olds of the opportunity to lie about how much sex they had. You know, or you wouldn't know them. They go to a different school. And I went on the J1 to New York, 1999, and I was working on the Upper East Side in a condominium and staying with a stranger. We found their ad in Columbia University, where all the J1ers used to land if you came to New York. And she happened to be working part-time at a music festival, and it was South Street Seaport, Sonic Youth were playing. She got us backstage, and we met Sonic Youth briefly. Now, in my mind, we chatted about their influences, but I asked...
You didn't just say, I have your t-shirt that I bought in Cork.
I nearly bought your t-shirt in Cork, as it turned out. But then I checked with a friend of mine who was there, and he said, I think we just said, hey, and they just, like, ignored us. So a memory can be deceptive. But I remember it for the reason that we had traipsed around New York for a while trying to get work. We had just got a job to start a couple of days later as doorman in condominium. This is it's brilliant, we're going to the gig. We were smoking a few, what you'd back call in Cork, the pinners, tiny little joints. And then we came back from a little bit of touristing, and our flatmate said, oh, hey, guys, your workplace just called, and it's fine. They just said you need to take a drug test before you do the job, but it's okay. My mate's a nutritionist, and she says if you drink plenty of green tea, you should be fine. So we drank 36 hours solid of green tea, and I'd say our sample was pure green tea, and we passed the drugs test and got the job. So that concert is rooted in also don't do drugs, it's bad, it's illegal, rooted in a very special moment. And it felt like the most New York American thing ever. Here we are, 5 days landed in the country, aged 21. And look at us, backstage at a Sonic Youth concert on the island of Manhattan. It doesn't get much better than this.
You have other concerts on the list, though, and you have two from the Electric Picnic in 2011, Arcade Fire and also Sly and the Family Stone.
Yeah, Arcade Fire, I'd heard about the amazing gigs they'd done both at Electric Picnic, and I think they'd played Whelan's earlier in the decade, and I was working really, really hard on a job. I didn't go to gigs, and so I started going to Electric Picnic and started catching up on lots of bands that I'd missed. So it was just amazing to get to see them at that. And also, I wasn't familiar with the new album. And sometimes you hear a band do new stuff and it's like, yeah, but I kind of came for the, you know, if I'm honest, I'm such a bad fan, but if I'm kind of honest, I kind of came for the stuff. And then they just played stuff from The Suburbs, I think, which is the album that was at the time. And it was like, I haven't heard a song before and it is blowing my mind and it is live. It's not like I'm hearing it on an album version where I have ultimate concentration. The idea that a new song would grab you for the first time, you're hearing it live. And then elsewhere at that festival, Sly and the Family Stone, another band that I'd inherited from older brother's tastes. And obviously Sly Stone, long gone through copious habits. But the rest of the band were there.
Just drinking lots of green tea didn't overcome.
No, there isn't. All the green tea in China wouldn't have masked poor old Sly Stone's intake. And it was just to hear that music from the albums, like, you know, There's a Riot Going On or People Every Day and all that stuff, Everyday People, all hear all that stuff live. It's just, and it brings you back to the times where you're sitting in February studying for the Leaving Cert, listening to music, you know, that you just brought back to that moment, soaring across time and space, if I'm going to be knobby about it. And you're watching them here live, you know, and there weren't that many people there, so I'm only 20 feet away from them.
When it comes to favourite books, you have picked a previous guest on this programme, but also be one of my favourite authors, the Australian Peter Carey. Why so?
Well, I feel like history of Australia, like many of us, and I know he doesn't write solely about Australia, but many of us think we know all about Australia. Like the Irish went there. There was penal colonies and indeed probably penal colonies as well too.
Yes, quite a few of them.
Subject
I'd
and object, yeah. And we have today's Australia, and it felt like a way of learning because a lot of the novels are, you know, they span long ranges of time, but just the kind of the grubby, like almost, you know, you think of Australia as, you picture the weather. It's hot and dry there, but almost the rainy, muggy, muddy history of Australia is how I'd kind of describe it. And to read, to find that out or get that sense while reading funny books or historical books or books that mix tragedy and humour all in the one go. Or to find, obviously, the true history of the Kelly Gang is a, you know, what would you call it, a fictionalised version of the truth, but even to get that sense that it's not beyond the movie or whatever, and other books he wrote, where he wrote about Paris and what's the name of it? It's about Tocqueville visiting America in the late 18th century, which sounds quite an arch topic, but then you're reading an account of what America is like, or a version from 300 years ago, and it still resonates today, the American attitudes and the good and the bad. So it's like he sneaks in an awful lot of history. Like, I never aimed to read them as historical novels. I heard that they were good reads. But to find out or to be immersed in a place and a time, and he does it in a way that doesn't hit you over the head with, and now I'm about to take out an 18th century musket. It is cleaned in the following way. You know, it's not, you're not burdened by history as you're reading them.
But your second choice is really interesting. A.A. Milne, why?
Two reasons. One, Winnie the Pooh, when I first got it, I understood it at a particular level. And then reading it multiple times, this isn't like the Tao of Piglet or the Tay of Pooh kind of way, more the way it represents childhood and imagination. And like that, towards the end of the second book, it's heartbreaking as Christopher Robin is describing to to Winnie the Pooh how, you know, things don't always stay the same and I may have to go somewhere. And where he's going is maybe big school or secondary school. And it's talking about that transition from childhood into whatever follows childhood. And it can often be, you can almost tear up reading it.
Are you reading these for your children out loud to them?
So that was like stage two. And now I'm reading those to the children and now and seeing, seeing Rabbit's passive aggression. You know, like the way Rabbit is insults Pooh without even telling him. And it's like, that's not a whole lot different to how some people I know, you know, interact. And also I'm reading Now We Are Six and When We Were Young, compilations of rhyme and nonsense rhyme. And Now We Are Six stands the test of time as any compilation of poetry in terms of the silly, the weird, and then the kind of evocative. Like there's a beautiful poem about a charcoal burner in the forest, and it's a snapshot of the past, but there's a wistful, it's as if he is talking about the passage of time as it would have been then at the start of the 20th century. And I'm surprised because these are poetry books for children, but I never get bored reading them to the children. You know, a story about an imaginary friend or the story about procrastination.
Well, Colin, we actually have an extract from Now We Are Six. This is Sneasels.
Christopher Robin had sneezles. They bundled him into his bed. They gave him what goes with a cold in the nose and some more for a cold in the head. They wondered if weasels could turn into measles, if sneasels would turn into mumps. They examined his chest for a rash and the rest of his body for swellings and lumps. They sent for some doctors in sneasels and weasels to tell them what ought to be done. All sorts and conditions of famous physicians came hurrying round at a run. They all made a note of the state of his throat. They asked if he suffered from thirst. They asked if the sneasels came after the weasels, or if the first sneasel came first. They said, if you teasle a sneasel or weasel, a measle may easily grow. But humour or pleasel the weasel or sneasel, the measle will certainly go. They expounded the reasons for sneasels and weasels, the manner of measles when new. They said, if he freezels in draughts and in breezels, then patheasels may even ensue. Christopher Robin got up in the morning. The sneasels had vanished away, and the look in his eye seemed to say to the sky, now, how to amuse them today?
And can you read it like that to your children?
Yes, I can very much mimic a lord of the manor. Just listening to it there now, I just realised that it's not too different to Facebook experts on how COVID is transmitted or treated. Like you're kind of like humour a sneasel or tease a weasel. Like that's, you know, I've seen worse online.
Okay, let's go to television. And we ask people as well to talk about the television that influenced them when they were young. What do you most remember from your childhood and youth?
Well, again, around the mid-90s, one important in terms of humour was RTE put on The End on a Friday and a Saturday night. And it was a sort of, so Sean McCreef would present the Friday, Barry Murphy would present the Saturday. And I've subsequently found that most people in RTE, like the head honchos, didn't even hardly know it was on. Like they weren't really over it. And you could tell because it was experimental.
This
and
is Barry
surreal.
Sitting on his couch, doesn't it? A bit of that.
The series Couched was almost like...
Oh, sorry, I'm mixing it up.
But it followed The End, but it was also a version of it. Like there was, they would make funny, like plasticine, surreal, like God and the Referee was a sitcom they had. Like it was clear that they knew none of the bosses in RTE were watching it, so they could do what they wanted. And they brought, and then they bought in stuff like The Rise and Fall of Reginald Perrin, which is a extremely underrated blackly comic sitcom from late 70s, maybe, with Leonard Rossiter, who was, people have known from Rising Damp. They also had Police Squad, which is the precursor to Naked Gun. So Frank Drebin, Leslie Nielsen, only 6 episodes.
We have a clip from that.
Ah, you're right on time, Lamekins. Make yourself a drink, baby.
No, thanks, Dutch.
Who are you and how did you get in here?
I'm the locksmith. And I'm the locksmith.
That's commonly acknowledged as one of the best jokes written for television. As he goes undercover as a locksmith to bust a crime boss, and it was so dense with jokes that part of the reason it was cancelled is that TV bosses said there was it was too much and it was too funny for people, or there was too much for people to get in it.
Give us a recent one, because you have gone for something that I don't think anyone else has nominated as their favourite current day television show.
Well, currently we just finished, is this She-Ra? Or
well, that's one that you have, and actually you have as well from recently, Justified.
Oh, Justified, yeah. So Justified with Timothy Olyphant is, I think it's one of the coolest programmes that didn't get to finish it out. Like, I think it got cancelled after season 6 or 7. So he is a US Marshal. So it's a modern Western. He is, you know, he's not a gun for hire, but he is somebody who makes his own rules. It's set in the hill country of Kentucky. So it has moonshine and it has, you know, the kind of Oxycontin, you know, the opiate epidemic as part of it as well, too. It's very modern, yet very old. It has Walton Goggins from Deadwood. It's just an incredible cast. And not enough people have seen it. And Timothy Olyphant in it is, I will marry the man. He's the coolest ever I have seen as a performance. You know, it's a traditional show in some ways because it is the Lone Ranger style. But the script, the acting, the setting, the plot, I would recommend anybody to
watch. We have a clip from it in which Raylan Givens is a dedicated marshal who, having committed a justified killing in Florida, has been reassigned to his hometown in Kentucky, and he's not happy about it.
So what are you going to do? In front of all these people, you're going to pull out a gun and you're going to shoot an unarmed man?
You're unarmed, huh?
Hey, you got eyes. You see a piece on me?
20 seconds.
Okay. 10. You know what? Seriously? You come and you interrupt my meal. You won't eat with me. This is bullshit. This is supreme bullshit.
Okay, got me interested in that.
Yeah,
one.
Do. You know, it's just cool. I mean, it's still okay to be cool on television.
What's She-Ra and the Princesses of Power?
A reboot of the Masters of the Universe's He-Man's sister, but rebooted for the modern age. And it ticks all the boxes for wokeness, but not in a way that would annoy you. Trust me, it's really good.
Okay, podcasts. You're picking out Dublin Story Slam.
This is shameless in that I am involved the Dublin Story Slam, but I wouldn't.
Hang on, you've come in here and you've promoted your new book and you're now coming in promoting a podcast as well. Go on, we leave you off, Colm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, shameless is the word. For the last few years, myself and Julian Clancy, who's a radio producer, have run a live storytelling night in the Sugar Club in Dublin, which is ordinary people telling true stories about their lives. And I'm always blown away by the capacity of people to tell a story, but the things that happen to ordinary people, they inspire me as a novelist to say most things are possible. And I'm not taking their stories, but it's the fact that when you see what happens to people, you go, well, anything could happen to my characters as well, because people who aren't adventurous, sometimes things just happen to them. And so we haven't had a live show over the last while, so we've kind of kept going with our podcast. And also we've done, it's one of the few things that have worked over Zoom. We've had Zoom gigs, you know, I think in total about 1400 people have logged on to a number of shows we've done over the summer. And people just love the idea of a yarn, a story that, but not told by the traditional Shanachie. People like us, you know, not media people, just people like us.
We have an extract from one of these Dublin Story Slam podcasts. This is Kerry Ward describing her MasterChef disaster.
In 2013, I had just graduated from college and I honestly didn't know what I was going to do with my life, but I was spending a lot of time in the kitchen. When the MasterChef applications opened, I kind of looked at it and I thought, you know, sure, why not? And I applied without really ever expecting anything to happen. And a week later, I got a call to say that I was through to the first audition. And really, it all went downhill from there. So for the first audition, I had to answer a bunch of questions over the phone. And the first question was, what do you make that you would consider to be high cuisine? Now, I was 22. I had never even eaten high cuisine. So I just started making shit up. Like, I just started naming dishes I had heard of. And I discovered that if you put the word deconstructed in front of any restaurant dish, people think you know what you're talking about. So I should have been knocked out then. Instead, I was invited to the second round of auditions. For the second audition, I had to make a cold dish and bring it to the audition venue where the producer ate it, asked me a lot of questions, and filmed me at the same time. Now, I made a bay leaf panna cotta with Turkish spice figs. It was beautiful. Nobody can take that away from me. But on the way to the audition, it melted. So by the time I actually got there, it was just a puddle of cream. I really should have been knocked out then, but I got through to the final audition. For the final audition, I had to live cook in front of a team of camera people. I had never cooked on gas before, and while I was heating a huge vat of oil for my tempura, I set an entire roll of kitchen paper on fire. Someone should have sent me home. Instead, I got a call to say, congratulations, you are going to be on MasterChef.
Kerry Ward describing her MasterChef disaster. Is that a typical example of
that's stuff? A typical example. That's from the stage of the Abbey. So we have done our kind of final of the year. We've done it on the Abbey stage, and it's the audience as well too. It's such a warm audience, kind of going, "Oh, wait, this is going to be good." You can hear the anticipation.
Putting people on.
Exactly.
Listen, we're out of time, unfortunately. That is it for today's Culture Club. Colm O'Regan, thank you very much. Best wishes for your new book, Anne Devine, Handled with Care.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live, on air, from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.